KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today we're continuing the conversation on Columbia's new Unified Development Ordinance. That's a document that guides many aspects of how our city grows and changes, from how tall buildings are to where they're built and how they're used. The new code was approved last month. This is the second in our two-part series on the issue, and if you'd like to hear last week's conversation with Columbia Mayor Brian Treese, you can find it on our website at kbia.org. This week, we talk with two people who were active in debates about the new Unified Development Ordinance and who have very different perspectives on it. First, we'll hear from President of the Columbia Board of Realtors, Jim Meyer, and then from Benton Stevens Neighborhood Association President Peter Norgaard. Here's Jim Meyer, President of the Columbia Board of Realtors and Managing Broker of Meyer Works, LLC.
I've been a realtor in Columbia, been licensed since 1993, worked in the industry other than some time when I was away here working at the university, and also have been away for military deployments with the Missouri National Guard. But otherwise, I've worked in real estate for most of the last 23 years.
So what do you think are the principal changes that the Unified Development Code makes that are going to affect property values?
Well, I think there are a number of things that it does. So there's been a lot of focus on downtown, that there's a lot of restriction on what a downtown property owner can do, the height restriction. Now that it's actually commercially viable to build taller buildings, which wasn't the case 23 years ago when I got in the business, now there's actually demand for that. You know, the ordinance is actually stopping that. You can't have a building higher than 10 stories where the market would demand taller buildings. So that creates a problem for financing and development of downtown properties. Also, the restrictions on what you can do along certain streets downtown with the main level of your building, that may be fine and dandy today, but when market conditions change, some of those restrictions are going to cause problems with the market being able to adjust to changes.
What might some of those changes be that could cause problems with the code as it stands now?
Well, there are certain kinds of companies that have trucks they'd want to park those near their buildings. There are certain kinds of construction companies, certain kinds of utility companies. Those kinds of things are being restricted in particular.
And a lot of the concern, I think, from people who live and work downtown is that large buildings go up, apparently not more than 10 stories, but we've seen, you know, some of these major developments downtown, they're directed at students. Sometimes they are buildings that don't have businesses on the first level. People are worried that they're taxing the city's infrastructure. People are worried that there's the possibility of a housing bubble as enrollment has declined recently. Is there really a demand? You mentioned before that there could be demand for buildings over 10 stories. Is that demand real here in downtown Columbia?
I believe it is because the student housing developments like Brookside, that catalyzed a lot of other interest in downtown. I have a client right now that sold a house near the Country Club of Missouri on the golf course. Well, it wasn't on the golf course. It was a block off. But in that area, you know, a house that sold for above $300,000, and those people are renting an apartment above a building on Broadway right now. So there is a demand from people other than students. There are young professionals without children. There are people who never have children of whatever age. There's retired people who downsize. There are a lot of people that like to live in an urban environment where they have restaurants and bars and shops within walking distance that's attractive for slices of all demographics. And I believe that's real, and I think that people who are characterizing everything that's happening downtown as just student housing are either short-sighted or they're not being very accurate. Because what happens is if student housing catalyzed the building of taller buildings, that creates a certain demand for increased demand for restaurants, for downtown shops of various kinds, for the grocery store like Lucky's. once those businesses are there and they're stable, you know, it builds on itself, and other kinds of people want to build downtown.
This is Intersection on KBIA, and today we're talking with Jim Meyer, president of the Columbia Board of Realtors, about the city's new updates to the development code. And how can buildings for that type of population be incentivized? Because I certainly looked to live downtown in an apartment, but when I looked at the available apartments downtown here, especially the more high-rise apartments, what I did find was that they were all directed at students, and they did have layouts like four bedrooms, four bathrooms, which, you know, like a young couple probably would not want to pay for four bedrooms and four bathrooms. How can those spaces that could be for retirees or young professionals or people who aren't students who want to live in a four by four, how can those be incentivized?
I don't think that's an issue of incentivized. I think it's a question of allowing the developers and builders to respond to the demand that's there. The first thing we've got to do is quit restricting supply and let the market sort it out. So you mentioned before the contention that there's a housing bubble in student housing and that that may burst. I don't argue against that. I think personally there is probably a housing bubble, but it's caused primarily by federal policy involving student loans. It's beyond the city's resources or ability to counteract. So the best thing to do is to have a flexible housing market and a flexible real estate market that can react to changes in market conditions. And modern buildings with steel frames can be remodeled very quickly and repurposed to new demand, a lot more so than a 100-year-old building.
When we spoke with the mayor, he said that when you take away a building that maybe had one bathroom and then you put in a building that's going to have 400 bathrooms, obviously that changes the load to the city's infrastructure, and the city has to take out bonds to pay for these things. And then if that building doesn't continue with as many residents or it becomes less profitable, it really affects the city's ability to pay for those infrastructure changes. Do you think that that could potentially be part of a housing bubble in Columbia?
I think that logic that you just spoke about, I can see the logic of that statement. I think the infrastructure, the lack of sewer infrastructure downtown is a lot of it is rhetorical. It's not real. First of all, builders and developers are often called upon to subsidize infrastructure off-site, not just the sewer pipes they're putting in their own buildings. They often contribute to repairs and sewer improvements, capacity improvements off the side of their building. So I think you have to take that into account and the value of all of that infrastructure that is being put in by the developer or builder. But I don't think that sewer capacity is really a limiting factor in downtown. Now, electrical capacity is, because the city has not completed the electrical upgrades because of the opposition in the southwest part of town to the city's chosen route. That has more to do with, you know, the route of the electrical line and the opposition from people who own property along that route. It doesn't have to do with a raw physical problem with capacity.
One of the things that there was a lot of debate over in the new Unified Development Ordinance was neighborhood protection standards. And so now with the new ordinance, there are some restrictions on building heights, parking, and lighting on new developments that share a border with residential housing. Some people say, and I believe you've said, that those requirements can violate property owners' rights to do what they wish with their property.
Yeah, I think those requirements, what the people who live in those neighborhoods need to remember is if they're going to enjoy property rights, the only way they can have their property rights respected is if they respect the property rights of their neighbors. And so when you start giving people, one group of people, special rights to cause their neighbors to back off of the property line, to lower their building heights, I think that's a very dangerous thing.
What about single-family property owners who say, you know, I bought into a single-family neighborhood, this is what I chose, that's where for me the value lies in my home, and I don't want, you know, 30-student bedroom complex going up next door to me?
Well, you know, the same sort of questions come up when I sell somebody a house in a subdivision in a more suburban part of town. Hey, I bought this house because there was a wooded, you know, stream buffer behind it, and then there was a field on the other side. And I never thought anybody would ever buy that vacant land and develop it. I just thought it was going to remain a pasture forever. Well, we take pains to point out to those people, you know, unless you border a park or some public ground that has some special protection, more than likely at some point in the future, that property will develop. And so, you know, I think people's expectations are not always accurate.
It sounds like the city council regards the new ordinance as not set in stone, that it's a living document that is flexible. Do you not see it that way?
I don't know how flexible it is. I've been involved in initial meetings with Farrell Madden, Don Madden, or Don Farrell, I believe was his name, the consultant, the primary consultant. I was in three or four small group meetings with him. I've testified at four or more of the Planning and Zoning Commission hearings. I've testified at the City Council hearing. I'll tell you that only one side of the debate gets any hearing or any significant effect on the outcome, and that's the people in those neighborhoods that surround downtown that are opposed to density and student housing in their neighborhood. All the comments that were made by people who are more supportive of property rights in general, the business community in particular, the owners of the buildings concerned, all of those comments have been marginalized, shunted aside, ignored throughout this 18 months that I've been a participant in this process. So no, I don't think that this is going to evolve in a way that is fair or reasonable based on the last 18 months experience. I think it will be tweaked in certain ways, but it won't be addressed in a way that affects the fundamental concerns I have with it.
So it sounds like you are more in favor of that you are in favor of significantly less restriction or requirement on the part of the city and more in favor of the private property owner's right to do what they please.
Exactly.
As long as it's not dangerous to other people. But it seems to me that when Mayor Treese ran, he was elected largely on the platform that people in Columbia did feel that building was out of control and that we were losing control of what's happening in our city. Do you think that's a logical fear?
I don't think that is a widely held fear.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think that there are certain people in those neighborhoods who are highly active politically and highly involved in testifying at city meetings that, you know, what happens is the city creates these echo chambers for itself where the same group of people who are appointed to all the boards and commissions testify at all the public hearings. It's pretty easy to be a mayor or a city councilor and begin to think that the points of view you're hearing week after week express the general sense of the community. And I think they've created a dangerous echo chamber for themselves, and they're not responsive to the general will of the community. And I think that will eventually come back to bite them.
That was Jim Meyer, president of the Columbia Board of Realtors, and this is Intersection on KBIA. Today, our guests are Jim Meyer, who we just heard from, and Benton Stevens Neighborhood Association President Peter Norgaard. Today, we're exploring different perspectives on the Unified Development Ordinance with our guests. Here's Benton Stevens Neighborhood Association President Peter Norgaard.
I'm the Neighborhood Association President, have been for the last year and a few months, and sort of the neighborhood provocateur as well, I suppose. We've been pretty active in the last year dealing with various issues like zoning and parking and compliance.
Yeah. And what is Benton Stevens for people who don't really know that neighborhood? Where is it? What is it like?
Benton Stevens is second oldest neighborhood in Columbia, I believe. It's bounded by College, Paris, Old 63, and Broadway, or I guess Walnut, technically.
Mm-hmm.
And It's basically a mixed-use neighborhood, and you know, roughly 15% of us are owner-occupants, but we make up approximately 50% of the actual homes.
Okay. So in your case, like, you own several properties, and you live in one in Benton Stevens.
I own no properties, but my wife owns 9.
Uh-huh.
So we also rent homes mm-hmm. there as well. But yeah, we live there, we play there, and we want to see it thrive as a neighborhood and not suffer from some of the pressures that excessive rental tenancy can cause.
And what are some of those pressures?
Well, some of the pressures are, you know, we deal with increasing levels of ambient noise, more parties, which we're not too happy about. A constant changing of tenants is pretty common when you're renting to undergraduates, although we try to rent to people that are longer term if we can. And I think most landlords would like that, but it's not a reality for many of them. So there's a lot of changeover. Many of the people that are renting are white people, so it affects the dynamics of the population dynamics in the neighborhood, and it changes the age demographics there as well. So there's a lot of interrelated issues. It increases parking. Parking density is the correct terminology. So we have a car storage problem in Benton Stevens right now, and a lot of that has to do with the way the city has developed the downtown area without giving consideration to auxiliary or ancillary neighborhoods.
So we have three major factors affecting Benton Stevens mm-hmm. in terms of zoning, as far as I can tell from reading. We have the Conservation Overlay District, mm-hmm. we have downzoning, and we have the city's new Unified Development Code.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with the Conservation Overlay, which I think highlights the fact that zoning in Benton Stevens has been an issue for at least 30 years, because this went into effect in the 90s.
Well, the city actually first studied the Urban Conservation District concept in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The particular overlay that we have right now wasn't instituted until 2000, 2001. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's just an additional layer of zoning requirements that puts further restrictions, typically on R3 developments. So an R1 zoned home in Columbia would allow up to 3 unrelated people. If you were to take that same home and rezone it to R3, you could now have up to 4, or you could have over 3 people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could add structures onto it and continue to add more people to it.
Could you build like a luxury student apartment building with R3 zoning?
No.
You couldn't?
No. R3 is typically currently, and I think also in the past, limited to typically 2 stories. Attached single-family homes are acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So think townhouses. That's a pretty common approach that's being used lately.
With R3.
Mm-hmm.
So with the overlay, it was more difficult to develop an R3 lot, or there were more restrictions on it?
Well, there are different restrictions. We'll put it that way. So when the original overlay was conceived, the city had a green space requirement citywide for R3 that was 15% of the lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured that wasn't enough, so we made it 25% back in the original overlay. At the same time, we relaxed parking requirements because the people that did it thought that somehow that would help to convince tenants to use the green space rather than fill it with cars. That turned out not to work. So in our overlay update, we've actually increased the green space requirement to 50%, which is more in line but not even close to the typical green space that residential homes in the neighborhood typically have. So many of the lots have 80% green space. So by making it 50%, we're taking away some of that perceived disparity in lot size. And then we've also tightened up the parking restrictions to existing parking standards. So previously we relaxed it. Now it's what the city would call the parking standard today.
So the overlay is like an extra layer of protections that residents bring forward and then city council needs to approve. Is that
correct?
The way it works?
Yeah. And so we advertised the changes at several of our neighborhood meetings, and we had a vote on it. It was essentially unanimous, with the exception of one developer who abstained, and he's a very well-known developer, and another developer who voted no. But City Council does have to approve those kinds of actions because they impact what people can do with their land.
That's really interesting. And so then if we talk about the downzoning, how did that process work and why did people in the Neighborhood Association decide to pursue it?
Well, the process is basically administrative. Mm-hmm. We contacted Steve McIntyre and he gave us a form, and then myself and Rita, my wife, basically went around and knocked on doors, and we got some additional help from one or two other people in the neighborhood. Basically, we just went door to door and appealed to people's sense of community and neighborhood, and then we accumulated all the information we needed, collected a $4 fee from everybody, handed it all to Steve, and their city inspector made sure everything was, all the deeds and everything were in place, and then they submitted it to City Council, Planning and Zoning.
Mm-hmm.
Planning and Zoning approved it, and then it went to City Council, and they approved it.
And so those homes have been downzoned now.
Yeah, so we downzoned 34 lots, 33 of which went from R3 to R1, and one of which went from R3 to R2.
And some people have said, why would people downzone like this? It's going to mean that when you go to sell your property, you can't sell it for as much money. So why was it worth it for you to potentially possibly lose out on property value?
Well, yeah. So I'm glad you put potentially in there. So that anybody that says that they know what the market's going to do is full of it. So it's impossible to say if it hurts the value or improves the value. Perhaps to the person saying that it's hurting the value, it hurts it from their perspective because they would have to go to these additional steps. But to a single family looking for a starter home, it may actually improve the value. So it's hard to say what the real impact of value is. But why would we do it? Because without the R1 designation, our neighborhood becomes or is open to becoming less mixed use and more rental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody decides that they have to move out and their home is R1, it's likely going to stay R1, and it's likely going to stay as a single family home. But if they move out and it's R3, you know, people are, developers in particular, who are connected to the realty society here in town, they recognize when a house in a neighborhood is for sale and they snatch it up and convert it into higher density use.
Mm-hmm.
And so by downzoning, you're making a statement that you like the neighborhood to be mixed use, and that's the neighborhood you bought into.
This is Intersection on KBIA. And today we're talking with Benton Stevens Neighborhood Association President Peter Norgaard. And when a person downzones to R1, like, nobody can be obligated to downzone, but
no.
If somebody downzones, it does affect the way the lots adjacent to that lot can be developed.
I think that's true to a small extent.
Mm-hmm.
When we, my wife and I, as well as several other neighborhood activists from other neighborhoods, were actively trying to work with City Council to increase neighborhood protections. This kind of leads into the UDO talk.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the protections that we sought were not accepted. The protections that are built into the current zoning code are so nominal, they're not going to hold a developer back. They're not going to prevent somebody from redeveloping.
Mm-hmm.
Our overlay protects us in our neighborhood pretty well. But the UDO protections are extremely modest.
So we've covered the overlay for Benton Stevens and the downzoning. And then, of course, as you explained, the overlay is actually part of the new unified development
mm-hmm.
code or ordinance. Tell me about your participation in the formation of that and what you see as its strengths and weaknesses.
Well, my personal view, not as a neighborhood president, mm-hmm. is that the changes that were accepted have some teeth, and they do increase the strength from strength of the code from the perspective of a homeowner in a mixed-use neighborhood. I don't think it goes far enough. It's also a balancing game, so we have to work with the developers if we want to be – I mean, we don't have to. But if we would like the developers to not put up eyesores everywhere, then we need to be friendly and work with them. Mm-hmm. And so there's a balancing game that had to be done at the city council level, and I'm hoping that the changes that were made are sufficient to at least wake the development community up and see it from a perspective of an individual that bought into a neighborhood could be years ago and has watched everything change right before their eyes, which is not something that happens in the home or in the neighborhoods where many of these people that are redeveloping actually live. So they don't have the firsthand experience of having everything change.
And when it comes to people saying, you know, people bought these properties with the idea of developing them and now they can't develop them the way they wanted to.
That's unfortunate for them. I know some of the people who have made that claim, and I believe most of the properties that they're talking about, they've owned for 30 or 40 years. So many of the people that have this or make this claim are, it's sort of a rhetorical argument rather than an actual argument. So I'm not convinced that that's actually true.
And is there anything else we should know about Benton Stevens and how zoning has affected that community and the steps the community's taken?
Sure. We have coming before City Council before too long a parking permit ordinance similar to the one that's in North Village. There's a number of people in the neighborhood that don't think that it's going to help. It might just make the problem move or change the dynamics of the problem. And then there's a lot of people in the neighborhood that just want to see something. And so I think the moral of this story is when enough people are relegated to the sidelines and are forced to sit and watch things happen without being able to have any direct input, things that impact their lives and their happiness, I think they get frustrated and action happens because of that. So I would say Columbia is a complaint-driven community. So if you're not happy with things, get vocal.
That was Benton Stevens Neighborhood Association President Peter Norgaard. Thank you for listening to Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And of course, thank you to our guests, Jim Meyer and Peter Norgaard, for joining us to talk about Columbia's new Unified Development Ordinance, which was approved last month. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we're at Intersect KBIA. Our producers are Claire Banderas, Meg Vaderot, and Trevor Hook. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM.